This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA FM and Pacifica Syndication. With the arrest of the former Prince Andrew, we can look back at other scandals in the history of England, such as the story of Henry VIII and his six wives, seen through the eyes of the great historian Antonia Fraser. On November 17, 1992, Richard A. Lupoff and I sat down with Antonia Fraser to discuss her then most recent work of nonfiction, The Six Wives of Henry VIII, as well as her mystery series, including its most recent book to date, The Cavalier Case, which was published in 1990. Antonia Fraser is now 93 years old. She's best known for her various biographies and nonfiction works, often focusing on women in history and on various members of the British Crown. She is also the author of several mysteries featuring her amateur detective Jemima Shore, published between 1977 and 1995, followed by two omnibus collections. At present, there are 17 works of history, plus three memoirs, one of which, Must You Go, My Life with Harold Pinter, was published in 2010. Antonia Fraser's most recent book, Caroline Lamb, A Free Spirit, was published in 2023.
Now, you started writing historical books for children, is this correct?
The very first thing I wrote was a version of King Arthur, and then I wrote a version of Robin Hood. I can't say I did much research for them. I was working for a publisher at the time, and they wanted a quick book, first of all, on King Arthur, and I used to write it late at night, very fast, write down the page, thwack, bang, and so the lance went into his shield, you know. So they were my first books, and in fact, they're still in print. Children do like them, perhaps because they have a sort of narrative zest, but the historical research, no.
But then you wrote some books on toys and dolls.
Yes, I wrote about antique toys and dolls. It was a field that interested me. My children were young, and I was in the world of toys, and I looked round and began to think how toys are certain universal shapes and universal types, you know. And I sort of, you know, I have that cast of mind. I got interested in it.
How does one do research on such a subject? How do we know, for instance, what toys Julius Caesar played with, or Jesus?
Well, we don't know what toys Jesus played with, but in fact, that they are the subject of a lot of myth. There's one story which I learnt in my Catholic girlhood of Jesus not really having any toys and not having any pets, and so he makes clay birds and he blesses them and they fly away as real birds. That's myth, which tells us something, but perhaps not, again, to do with historical research.
But the question remains then.
When it came to doing my history of toys, I researched, I suppose, in the same way. I mean, I divided up the subject into areas in the world. I read books, one book led to another. I mean, I learned a lot of method from doing history of toys. Dolls was a shorter book. But I think that I was equipped to do Mary Queen of Scots by cutting my teeth on history of toys.
And that was your next book. This is still long before you turned to mysteries, correct?
Long before I turned to mysteries. At that time, I was an avid mystery reader, and I used to sometimes think, one day I'll write a mystery myself, which will be better than all of these, or which will not be as good as all of these. But it was a very long time before I wrote mysteries.
What mysteries, who did you read at the time?
I read, when I was young, I read Dorothy Sayers. I haven't read her recently. She had a great effect on me. I loved Lord Peter Wimsey, you know, and I thought I was Harriet Vane. And then, as I grew older, I liked Patricia Highsmith very much. I think she's had a great influence on all mystery writers coming after her. I don't believe you'd have someone like Ruth Rendell, who I much admire, without Patricia Highsmith. I mean, I think that's a sort of line of literary suspense. I like a mystery writer who's, I gather, two ladies called Emma Latham, very much indeed. I always enjoy those. I sometimes have a problem. I buy the most recent one in the States, and then it comes to England, and I buy it again.
I got interested in English history by reading a mystery, The Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay. You familiar with that?
I am indeed familiar with that. What a wonderful book that is. And when I wrote The Cavalier Case, which I think you mentioned is my last full-length Jemima Shore, I had in mind a kind of Daughter of Time mystery. I mean, of course, it turned into something quite different, as books do if they have a real life of their own. But I much admire Daughter of Time.
In that regard, your latest book, Henry VIII and His Wives, deals a little bit with the aftermath of the events that take place in Daughter of Time, which is the story of what really happened to the princes in the Tower and Richard III. And Tay postulates that Richard III was a good guy and, in fact, was much maligned during the Tudor reigns of Henry VIII and of Elizabeth, who came afterward. What do you think?
Well, I have a principle of never talking about Richard III publicly in Britain, because if you do mention him in however casual way, you get 2,000 letters, 1,000 of which say that he's a maligned saint and the other that he was a murderer of small boys. He's such a sort of emotive figure. However, in the security of the United States, I've always thought you have to ask cui bono, who benefited from the death of the princesses of the Tower. I mean, I've read quite a lot about it. And the fact was that as long as those boys were alive, Richard III did not have a title to the throne. He did try to pretend they were illegitimate, you know, one of those larks of saying their father had been engaged to contract it to another woman before he married their mother. But in fact, as long as they were alive, people were going to rescue them. They would grow older and they would always be a threat. And then they vanish. So I would need, with due respect to Josephine Day, I would need a lot of proof before I was convinced of the idea that it was done by other people, although I know all the clues, the laundry lists, and all the rest of it.
To us here in America, I must say that British royalty, and more than that, the passion that British people feel about royalty is this totally exotic phenomenon. Why is there such passion over people who have been dead for centuries?
Well, it's a connection to our history. I mean, you feel great passion, for instance, about the American Civil War, that wonderful television series which did come over to Britain. In fact, I enjoyed it very much, but we're very ignorant about the American Civil War. But you feel great passion about it because it connects to your history. It leads you back. It leads you forward. And I think the same is true. Don't forget that in the reign of Henry VIII, the Church of England was established. I mean, the whole religious composition of our country was altered, with consequences that still remain today. And also the monasteries, which were part of our culture, were most regrettably vandalized and destroyed. So there really was a different England as a result of the events that I describe in The Wives of Henry VIII. So I think it's natural and intelligent to be interested in it. It isn't just sort of tabloid interest in royalty, though there's that too.
But there seems to be this fascination in particular with an era that you cover in a number of your books, which is the era where the Plantagenets gave way to the Tudors, and then the Tudors gave way to the Stuarts, mostly pre-Cromwell. What is the fascination, you think, with that particular era?
Well, of course, I did write post-Cromwell about Charles II as well. I mean, I followed through the whole of the 17th century, as a matter of fact, though I haven't gone to the point where the Stuarts gave way to the Hanoverians. Well, certainly our Civil War, to go back 300 years. Our Civil War is the foundation of our parliamentary system in its true expression. The rights of free speech, law, rights of people under the law, all the things that are still being fought in and out of Parliament, censorship, quite apart from Puritanism and dictating to other people how they should live in private as opposed to a more public kind of direction of people's lives. All of these things are still happening. So it's natural to find the 17th century interesting. And I think that, of course, I veer depending on what I'm working about. But I would never say that I don't find the 17th century the most interesting. And yet, when I went back for the Six Wives of Henry VIII, I loved that late medieval period. And I began to meditate one day doing a book called The Brothers, which would be Richard III and Edward IV. That would be a good book, wouldn't it? I guess, I mean, I love dramatic periods of history, particularly ones which, as you've said, alter, where one epoch really gives way to another, particularly as people living at the time don't wake up in the morning and say, I believe we are in a new epoch. And so it's nice to sort of trace how they live their lives.
Well, there's one point you make in your introduction to The Wives of Henry VIII, which is that while we look at Henry VIII as having the six wives and all that came, as Henry was living it, he had no idea how many wives he was going to have, and in fact, for the first 18 years, had one.
Indeed, for longer, actually. I mean, the first 20 years, and in effect, for 24 years. No, I think this very obvious statement is, in fact, a tremendous insight. When I wrote that down, I thought, yes, this is very important, not only because it's obvious he didn't know, but it's very important as a way of writing this particular book, because if you write it backwards, then you explain all his motives, all his moves, all the wives' moves, in terms of there are going to be six of them. Whereas if you told him when he was 18 that he would have six wives, well, he would put you in the tower for presumption, or said, you're so mad that I shall just stick you in the stocks until you feel better. I mean, he simply wouldn't have believed it. He believed, rather like serial marriers today, he believed each wife was the last wife, not only the perfect wife, the one who would give him a son, but also the last wife. And I think this is very important about him psychologically. Also very important about the wives not being so passive. If they're just people who were born to be married to him one after the other, then they are rather passive characters, whereas many of them were active and strong.
A point that Dick and I have been talking about with relation to mysteries is when you write a mystery, you actually write it from the back forward, and then after you've figured it out, or other people, not you necessarily, the killer is determined and the motive, and then you start from the front and write through. And obviously, even though you, the author, may know the killer, the people in the book don't. And it's sort of similar to the way one should view history then.
Yes, I completely agree with that. I think that people sometimes say you do two very different things. And then on a phone-in, somebody phoned in and said, but you don't actually. In both cases, you are a detective. You are uncovering the truth. But I should just like to say that I don't write mysteries like that. Many celebrated mystery writers do. My friend P.D. James writes like that. She does something even more bizarre. She writes sort of bits. She jumps about. She writes wonderful books. Agatha Christie always wrote backwards in the later years. But I like to write it as it's lived, which is rather exhausting. And I like it to be possible for there to be four murderers. Because if the reader is going to be fairly baffled, then it must be possible for four people to have done the crime, for example. You know, in A Splash of Red, I think I have four people. And I didn't decide which one of these had actually done it until very late on, because by not knowing myself, I gave each of them plausible psychological reason to do it, as well as, of course, an opportunity. I think it makes it better and more interesting for the reader. It's also fairer. But as you say, it is also like history.
When you figured out which one it was, did you go back and put in clues?
Yes, of course I did. Once I'd figured out which one it was, then I had to go through and go back and write, he did not climb up the winding tower, as opposed he did. And the funniest thing that happened once, I stopped halfway writing a mystery for some good reason. It doesn't matter. Perhaps I went on a trip. And I came back, and there was this blood-stained tennis shoe, and it was clearly extremely, I mean, in the book, not in my home, it's obviously frightfully significant, the blood-stained tennis shoe, but I had made no note of what its significance was. And after that, I learned that whenever I go away, even for two or three weeks, I always write down exactly where everything's leading.
We're talking about the two Antonia Frasers, the mystery writer and the historian biographer, at the same time, and yet they really are the same person. So pardon me if we're jumping back and forth, but to revert to the wives of Henry VIII, I believe you yourself use the metaphor that the book is, you say the book is about the wives, which it is, and yet you use the metaphor that Henry is the maypole around which they dance.
Yes, a maypole of increasingly gigantic girth is what I think I said.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Henry because, as a relatively ignorant person, I know only the popular image of Henry and saw the wonderful Charles Laughton movie called The Private Life of Henry VIII. in which he comes across as a rather sympathetic character, and yet when you think about some of the monstrous things he did, it's hard to accept that. I would like to know your feeling about this man.
I think what one has to realize about Henry VIII is he began as one thing and ended as another, which is true of many careers. And yet we have such a strong image of him as one thing that we forget how he began life. He began life aged 18 when he came to the throne as the handsomest prince in Europe. Slim, athletic, golden hair, blue eyes. And this description, the handsomest prince in Europe, was given by rival ambassadors who had no reasons in writing private letters to gloss over the truth. He ended a man with a 54-inch chest and a 54-inch waist. How do we know? Because we have his armour in the Tower of London, which had to fit, and, you know, you could go and gawp at it. Now, between those two, he also went from being charming, intelligent, musical, a Renaissance man, to being a bloodstained monster who had the heads of people cut off, even an old lady like Margaret, Countess of Salisbury, if he could just dream that they threatened him, which they didn't. So he makes a journey. And one of the things I discovered, again, obvious, but very important, is that each of the wives married a different man, if you see what I mean.
I see a double image in my mind. You may find this extremely bizarre, but I'd like your comment anyway. I can't help seeing Henry VIII as a sort of Stalin.
No, I don't find it bizarre at all. In fact, I didn't use the comparison in my book because I think you've got to be very careful with modern comparisons in a book which one hopes may last a year or two, because there was a Life of Cardinal Wolsey by an academic that came out 2 years ago, and he compares him to the most powerful people in the world, President Reagan and Mrs. Thatcher. And by the time he made the comparison, whatever you may think of that comparison anyway, by the time he made the comparison, they'd both gone. So I'm quite wary, although, of course, Stalin is Stalin. But it's a comparison I use in my own mind, and I have used it in giving speeches. You know, I think it's a valid one, because I think that in both cases, absolute power corrupted them. And in both cases, a bloodbath started, and once it had got there, there was no reason to stop, you know. I mean, he was ordering Henry VIII, ordering the execution of people in a way very similar to Stalin, just having people polished.
And yet he was not simply an evil monster. There's a tragic dimension there as well.
Yes, and I don't think that one can compare him to Stalin, in that I've recently read a very interesting Russian biography of Stalin using the archives by Volkogonov. And it's clear that Stalin was born a thug and went on to be a tyrant, whereas Henry VIII made a sadder progression, if you like. If you think the corruption of a once fine person is more tragic, which I do, then I think there is a tragic dimension. However, there is more of a tragic dimension to his wives, quite frankly. I mean, Henry died in his bed at really quite an advanced age for those days, whereas the wives had, two executions, two divorces, a sad, lonely death for Catherine of Aragon, two deaths in childbirth, where we can't blame him for that because that was the lot of womankind. So I find more of a tragic dimension to his wives' lives than to his, although, of course, he was the major political figure.
One of the points you make in the book is that the fact that Henry wanted a son was not merely a case of male chauvinism, I've got to have a boy, but he wanted to avert a civil war.
He believed he wanted to avert a civil war. I believe that the primitive desire to have a son existed anyway. One can feel a certain sympathy for him. There were people alive who could remember the Wars of the Roses and the anarchy that existed in England at that time. And he also inherited this paranoia from his father, Henry VII, who had ended the Wars of the Roses in 1485 at the Battle of Bosworth when he defeated Richard III. One can feel a certain sympathy, but I don't think one should feel tolerance of it. It was quite unnecessary. These people were not threatening him, these cousins. I mean, they really weren't. They were not conspiring. And he got in a paranoid state, had them taken off to the Tower of London. And of course, there were always people to agree. Of course, they'd conspired and to tell him stories. And their heads were chopped off. So, as I say, one can understand it, but one shouldn't tolerate it.
And finally, in the end, after he died, when all the dust cleared, who was left but a daughter? Elizabeth.
That is so ironic, isn't it? I mean, that's the moment at which our hindsight can't help breaking out, you know, and thinking that this girl that was such a disappointment, born in 1533 to Anne Boleyn, the girl they were so sure was going to be a boy that they had the announcement, the official announcement written out to the queen, a prince, you know, and they had to put in the extra S's to make it a princess. And that was going to be, I think, arguably the greatest monarch of our shared heritage, Queen Elizabeth I.
You go into depth into the lives of the different wives. A woman's lot was very, very different than what it is now. Women were not expected, I would guess, to live too long. For instance, you make mention of Queen Claude of France, who died at the age of 24 after something like 6 or 7 kids and died in childbirth. How would a woman like Catherine feel, the first Catherine, going into her 30s still alive? I mean, isn't that unusual in itself, given the number of babies who died?
Yes, I think childbirth was a perpetual threat. I don't think it was rare to be alive in your 30s if you didn't have children. But if you had a lot of children, then it was rare. Of course, Catherine didn't have a lot of children. She miscarried them. But it's interesting, you know, that so many women died young and the men married again. But every now and then you'd get a woman who lived a very long time. Henry's grandmother, Margaret Beaufort, the learned lady, Lady Margaret Beaufort, founder of many learned institutions, she was married at 12, bore her only child at 13. That was Henry VIII's father, Henry VII. The act of bearing that child far too young meant that she could never have any more children. But that fact saved her, and she lived on to an enormous age to be a sort of matriarch. So it was interesting. People sometimes talk as though it was more monolithic, as though everybody died young. That's not correct. Many people did. Childbirth was a very dangerous process because nobody knew anything about disease and septicemia and infection. And the more they tried to help on the process of birth, the more they spread the infection. So rich and grand women were in more danger than the women of the people. Ironic.
And rich and grand women also had their marriages chosen for them to a greater degree, I would think. You mentioned one case, I can't remember who, maybe it was Anne Boleyn's sister, who married for love.
Yes, to marry for love was considered to be quite disgusting, you know, really wrong. And when Mary Boleyn married, I think it was William Carey, and she said, "I care not for the best match in the world, I want to marry him," everyone was shocked, because even if you actually married for love, you glossed it over as being the will of God, you know, this was God's destiny, or it was a good match. And to marry for money was considered to be a very good thing. I mean, I always think, when I was writing The Weaker Vessel, my book about women in the 17th century, things have reversed. I believe that many of them did marry for love, but they pretended they'd married for money. Position. Nowadays, I think people do marry for money, but they have to pretend they've married for love.
I would like to get into the minds of these six extraordinary women, each extraordinary in a different way. I'm trying to understand why one of these women, especially the later wives, oh, anywhere from number 4 onward, would marry this man in view of his track record.
Well, you see, to marry the king was the ultimate career opportunity, if I may put it like that. Not only did you become queen, which was by far your best hope of securing a position in the world, but all your family went up with you. And let's take the Boleyns. They all go up and get great positions, which, of course, they lose when Anne Boleyn is executed. The Seymours went up and remained up because they are then the uncles of Jane Seymour's son, Edward, and the future king, Edward VI. And so there are ducal families in Britain still today whose name is Seymour from that. The Howards go up with Catherine Howard. down again into the tower when she's executed. The Parrs go up, and because Catherine Parr survived Henry, the Parrs stay up, and again there are noble families. The Marquis of Northampton's family name is Parr, and he descends directly from Catherine Parr's brother. So with your family around you saying, go on, do it, you would have to be in rather a bold young lady to have said, no, I won't. And in fact, neither Catherine Howard nor Catherine Parr, both of whom were in love with other people, hesitated. That's what you did. It was your duty as a subject.
Even knowing that he had divorced this one, he had beheaded that one, divorce might not be a very pleasant prospect, but it sure beats getting your head chopped off.
Absolutely. I entirely agree with you. And I think by the time he cut off the head of Catherine Howard, his fifth wife, I think no European princess would have married him, because that really scandalized people, and he divorced Anna of Cleves, who was a European princess. I think that it had to be a subject, but from the point of view of the wives who were subjects, notably the second wife, the third wife, and the fifth and sixth wives, they just simply didn't look at it like that. I mean, I would shudder from the idea of being married to that horrible, gangrenous, fatto of man, but they didn't see it like that. They saw the advantages, and they really had a different mindset, and one has to realize that.
But toward the end, didn't the last couple kind of get the idea that he wasn't going to live much longer?
I think Catherine Howard probably thought that he wouldn't live forever, but what she didn't realize, she wasn't going to live forever, and she went first, executed for her undoubtedly very stupid behavior. In fact, I always refer to her as the first bimbo, which I think is the description she deserves, poor thing. I think Catherine Parr also knew that he wouldn't last a very long time, and she saw her duty to be a good sick nurse to him, which she did very faithfully, and she also to look after his children and his three children by his three other wives, and she performed both of these duties, both of which were conventional female duties of the time. Many women brought up other women's children who had died in childbirth, and they were always known as mother. The word stepmother didn't exist because it was so frequent. These Mary, Elizabeth, and Edward refer to Catherine Parr as our mother, and they were very fond of her. And nursing, again, was a conventional female activity that she was supposed to be good at, and she was good at.
Could you tell us a little bit about the everyday lives of these people? Again, we see them as sort of characters in a pageant, but they had to eat breakfast and go shopping, or maybe they didn't have to eat breakfast and go shopping. What was their daily life?
They wouldn't go shopping in that sense, but they would have tailors and sempstresses round, and merchants who'd been abroad bringing them velvets, and they would order clothes. So they wouldn't literally go shopping. They would order jewels. They would order shoes. They all loved shoes. Of course, you see, with all the mud, I think that their shoes got frightfully dirty. Catherine Parr, I think, had a passion for yellow taffeta shoes. We see it in her accounts. If you think of the grime, you know, I suppose one pair of yellow taffeta shoes didn't last very, very long. As to what they had eat, we know from the household accounts they didn't drink water, because if you did drink water, you're probably dead within the hour. They drank beer automatically, rather as we would drink water. They didn't drink coffee or tea, which hadn't come to England then. So they drank beer, what was called small beer, and wine, and Malmsey, and all those things you read about in Shakespearean plays. And of course, that was healthier than this terrible typhoid bearing water.
How did they spend their days and how did they spend their evenings? Obviously, not watching television.
They went hunting a lot. I mean, they all took a lot of exercise, naturally. I mean, everybody rode, because that's the way you got from place A to place B, unless you went in a litter or something. They went hunting, and they loved that. And they used to move from castle to make it be clean. Hygiene, by our standards, would be absolutely appalling. I mean, if we were transported to Hever Castle, shall we say, which is south of London in Kent, I think the first thing we'd notice would be the stench, and then we'd be amazed that no one else would notice it. Because although there were what's called water closets in turrets, practically no one used them.
In that regard, you have a scene where Henry VIII is walking down the hallway. Is he afraid of stepping in feces?
Yes, and particularly dog turds. How do we know? Because you can always tell what went on by all the laws against it. And there were some household orders called the Eltham Ordinances, in which they said dogs shall not be permitted in the bedrooms, dogs shall not be permitted in the corridors. Above all, dogs shall not be permitted in the passage but from the king's, what we would now call suite of rooms, to the queen's suite of rooms, because when he walks, he will not put his foot in the filth, which immediately shows you that that's what went on. It seems so disgusting to us. I mean, that way, things are so different that we really can't understand it. Just as if we're time travellers again, the fact that all these people, some of whom were considered very beautiful, would have blackened stumps of teeth. Dentistry consisted of a really strong blacksmith pulling out a rotten tooth. So,
one of the latest trends in mysteries, which we've encountered a few times, is the idea of writing a historical mystery. And usually what happens in these is that the person will very often stick what we would consider somebody with modern views in that particular era. How would a person with modern views respond actually living in that era? Could a woman have even remotely feminist views then?
Not as such. I mean, if she had the kind of feminist views which would not even be extreme today, just perfectly normal, like why shouldn't women go to university, just to give an example, I think she'd be considered to be seriously mad and would be dragged away, you know, and people would give her potions to bring down her fever. I mean, so that completely unexceptionable view that women should go to universities, I mean, would be extraordinary if somebody thought they shouldn't. That would be considered just crazy. So in some ways, a woman couldn't have a feminist view, but that is just a modern feminist view. A woman could have a sense of herself, a sense of independence, and Anne Boleyn did, but she would exercise it in patronage, in chaplains, in an interest in religion, you know, which was considered to be rather unfeminine. And she might say, well, God made women as well, why shouldn't I take an interest in religion? So these kind of feelings have always existed in women's breasts, but she would have to put them into practice in a very, very different way.
Have you ever thought of writing a historical mystery?
Well, in the Cavalier case, I sort of alternate between the time of Jemima Shaw and the 17th century. But the reason I've not done a straightforward historical mystery is that I decided I couldn't get the language. And as a historian, I couldn't bear cod language. I mean, I can't really read historical novels because I know they haven't got the right language, and it upsets me reading modern language, so that I doubt whether I would do so. If I was to write about a historical mystery, I think I'd rather do it in a non-fiction way. The dialogue would be a problem for me.
Jemima Shaw is your detective throughout. She's an interesting character. She is not a sleuth in the traditional sense. She's a professional woman. She's a broadcast journalist.
She's an investigative journalist. In fact, when I first wrote about her, which was in 1976, I really modelled her on Barbara Walters, who I knew. And I noticed that if you sat in a restaurant with Barbara Walters, everybody came up and said hello. And I mean, because I didn't live here, I didn't realize why she was so famous. And I said, you know, and they would ask her things. And I said, you know those people? She said, no, but I mean, she was very polite. She said, no, they think they know me. And it occurred to me it would be a very good formula for an amateur sleuth, because it is always the problem. Why is this person always falling over corpses? Why are the public so determined to ask her to solve their problems? And I think there is a kind of television investigative fame, you know, I mean, Diane Sawyer or someone you might use as a sleuth.
Do you intend on writing more of these?
I hope so, yes. Definitely, I enjoy writing.
The critic Lynn Pickett, in referring to the Jemima Shaw novels, mentions, although a Protestant, Shaw, like her creator, is convent-educated.
Yes.
And then she goes onward from there. But that does strike me as a rather odd conjunction of factors. I'd like you to comment on that, if you would.
In the first Jemima Shaw, Quarter to None, I do explain it, that Jemima Shaw is a Protestant day girl. She happens to live near a Catholic convent, and that happens. I mean, I actually am a Catholic, though I used to be a Protestant, and so I had the experience of going to a convent as a Protestant, though I became a Catholic, unlike Jemima Shaw. But there were Protestant girls there who lived nearby. It was convenient. It's perfectly plausible, because England is not a Catholic country and doesn't have a large Catholic population. Catholic schools are not so segmented, you know. Nuns would quite often need to take in a few Protestant girls. I just didn't want to make Jemima Shaw exactly like myself. I wanted to have my experience of confronting a convent as the alien, the other, which I had. But I didn't then want her to have a conversion. That's not what she's about. You know, we don't care about her religious views.
You've written a book about Mary, Queen of Scots. You've written this book about Henry. You've written about the Stuarts. What do you see yourself doing next?
I'm going to write about a historical mystery that's always fascinated me, the Guy Fawkes mystery, the guy who planned to blow up the Houses of Parliament, which is rather like the assassination of JFK. Nobody really knows, even now, who did it, though many people have tried to interpret it. It may have been a complete government setup, a conspiracy, in order to do down the Catholics, or it may have been a straightforward Catholic plot. Anyhow, watch this space.
We would speak with Antonia Fraser one more time 4 years later upon the publication of the Gunpowder Plot, Terror and Faith, in 1605. You've been listening to an interview with Antonia Fraser, recorded November 17, 1992, while she was on tour for The Six Wives of Henry VIII. My co-host was Richard A. Luboff. This interview was digitized, remastered, and edited on February 20th, 2026, and has not been heard for over 30 years. Until next time, I'm Richard Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.
Today, Luboff.